In the studio, we've got Stephanie Philp. Good morning.
Good morning, Aaron. Morning, listeners. Morning,
Thank you for turning up. I always like it when my guests do that.
Yeah, it helps, doesn't it?
It does. It helps me, especially. So we do a segment called Inside Your Mind with Stephanie. And you're a... How do you describe yourself in a title? A life coach?
No. There's three things I do. One is I train people in neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. I coach people... And I write.
So we can't give you a title?
I'm a master NLP trainer and master NLP coach trainer.
Okay.
And my title is head, in inverted commas, consultant.
Oh, you actually do. That's right. You do. You've given yourself a title within your company, which is you. All right. So today we're talking about... What are we talking about?
Well, we're going to talk about... fun and laughter. It's a bit miserable, so it's a good thing to
know.
Talk about.
Yeah, it's like I've got to force myself into the right mindset. But after grumping about my guests not turning up and talking about council things, which are always grumpy things anyway, but it seems like a good idea. So many people seem angry at the moment. So.
Well, I think the thing is we can focus on all the negative in the world. Mm. But, you know, really, if you just go outside here, walk up and down and chat to a couple of people, you'll realise that, you know, the whole world isn't like that.
Yeah. I think we, not that we pay too much attention to the news, but we give it too much prominence in our minds.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's and it's unhealthy, literally unhealthy.
Yeah, and you don't know how much of it is accurate either. That's the other thing.
Well, yeah, if you bring that into it, then we kind of feel really lost. So, yeah, let's make a joke. You got any good jokes?
Is that how we have. Actually, the other day I went on to X, was Twitter. And I just come across this thing on...
It's called X Twitter.
Well, it's called X now.
Yeah, if we call it X Twitter, then like... I just thought of this now. Right. Like, as in you say something, that's my ex-husband.
Oh, right.
it's X Twitter.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It is too. Yeah. There you go, you made a joke.
Very nice.
Somebody had put a post up about Tommy Cooper. And so Tommy Cooper was a comedian when I was growing up, and he was hilarious. He was like 6'4". He looked funny. He got a really rubbery face, and he always looked like he just landed there from another planet. You know?
Yeah.
And he wore a fez, red fez, and he was a magician. But most of his tricks just failed miserably. That was part of the comedy. But then he'd do something out of the ordinary. Anyway, somebody had put up this post about, and it was a photograph of. Tommy Cooper with the Queens. That must have been the Royal Variety performance after, with a guy named Bob Monkhouse and some other people. I can't remember what the names were now. Anyway, it was a black and white photograph. And apparently it said to the Queen, can I ask you a personal question? And the Queen said, yes, okay. And he said, do you like football? And she said, well, no, not really. And he said, well, can I have your ticket to the cup final? And this is a true story. So somebody put that up. And then all these people had put up their favourite jokes that Tommy Cooper would come out with, you see. And they're mostly one-liners. And so I was reading through these and I was cracking up because I've actually got a post on my website called Tommy Cooper Classics.
Yeah.
And I'd got about 46 different things that he you know, jokes that he'd said, and they're all quite short. And so I was reading through these, and some of them I hadn't come across before, like, doctor, I keep thinking I'm a moth. And the doctor says, I think you need a psychiatrist. And he says, well, I was going to see the psychiatrist, but your light was on, so I thought I'd pop in.
That was on your Facebook feed.
Yeah, so. I put that on there yesterday. Yeah. So there was all these different jokes that I hadn't got. So now I've got 50 Tommy Cooper classics on the website.
There we go.
And he was just a, like some of the jokes are quite naive, but he just had the timing and the look. I mean, Dad and I would sit when I think he used to come on Saturday night about 5:30 or something on TV. And Dad and I would be sitting there waiting for the show to start on TV. And we'd be cracking up laughing because my mum would come in and she'd go, what are you laughing at? And we go, Tommy Cooper. She goes, it's not on yet. And we go, oh no, but it's just the thought of it used to make us laugh, you know. And she'd just got to go, roll her eyes, leave the room. She didn't think he was as funny as we thought he was, you know. But it was really interesting watching this feed and all the jokes that people had come up and stories about him and other comedians and all that. And he's got a thing in the Victoria and Albert Museum of some of his jokes and work and that, you know.
I don't suppose the Queen actually let him take her tickets. That would be,
it's a cheek of it, though.
It would have been hilarious. Well, it doesn't seem cheeky today to a New Zealander, yeah. Right? That's the sort of thing New Zealanders would do all the time, I think. But yeah, in England, that probably... He probably landed just the right side of what's acceptable, unacceptable, yeah, I imagine, for England.
Yeah. And the thing was, as well, he did all these jokes. There was no swearing. Mm. They were often... I mean, if other people couldn't even tell him because it just wouldn't be funny. It was the fact that he...
I had a friend like that. If you tried to repeat what he'd done or said, he just couldn't do it in the way he did it. And it just, yeah.
And then there was one guy said he went to, I think it's Turkey, where the fez comes from. Is it Turkey?
Why not?
Or Egypt, maybe.
Morocco.
Somewhere, anyway.
Somewhere around the Mediterranean.
Yeah, and he said he was in the market and he found a fez and he put it on. And the guy that was selling him said, just like that, because he used to go, just like that, with his hands, you know, when he was doing these magic tricks.
That sounds familiar.
And the guy said, do you know Tommy Cooper? He says, no, but he says, so many people come and put the hat on and they go, just like that. Just like that. So he didn't know Tommy Cooper, but he knew that a lot of English people obviously knew about the fez, and that was what they'd say.
That's, yeah, you know, you've heard it when you know you've done well when you start a catchphrase.
That's right, and it's still going now. You know, so all these people were putting that up there, and he actually Tommy Cooper died on stage. He had a heart attack, and people thought he was part of the show.
is that what you want as a comedian? Your very last thing you do makes people laugh.
I think he probably is, you know. I mean, if that's what your love is and you go out doing what you love, well, isn't that the one of the definitions of having had a good life or something?
Was you wrapped it up well anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and you were saying off the air that learning to laugh at yourself is the importance of that.
Yeah. So I think I said to you off air, I think I've always had a good sense of humour. Part of that was growing up in England with a Jamaican father and an English mother maybe a protection mechanism, but both my parents have got a good sense of humour as well. But being able to laugh at myself was a different thing, you know. It was because I always had to be perfect, basically. So anything that you do that would make you laugh, it was like, laugh at yourself, that wasn't really par for the course, you know. I didn't want to do that.
So your dad was West Indian, so were you like the only not white person in your class or something?
Yeah, it was in the whole school.
In the whole school?
Yeah, in the whole school, yeah.
Oh, wow. What town were you in the UK?
Well, the place was Walsall, we were in Bloxwich, which was about 3 miles from the bigger town. It was still, you know, a big, it sounds like a village, but it was more of a town. And in fact, one of the reasons...
It's near something that we've heard of?
It's probably about 30 miles from Birmingham.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Walsall, and then Bloxwich is about 3 miles from there, and it was interesting. One of the reasons I went to Bloxwich Secondary Modern School, it was called, because the guy that bullied me in primary intermediate school, I suppose you'd call it here, decided he was going to go to the other school, which was called T.P. Riley. And I was going, like, I'm not – and that was a big comprehensive school. I had, you know, I don't know, 1,000 students or something. There was about 120 or something at the school I went to. The reason I went there is because he was going to the other place, because I was fed up of being bullied and pushed around the whole time.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah. So I ended up being head girl there, which, I don't know, I think they must have been desperate that year or something. It was, you know, but even then, I still got bullied. In fact, I wrote an article about personality conflicts and used the example of Jean Owen. So Jean Owen was this woman, a girl at the time, used to bully me all the time, push me around. And anyway, this one day I must have just had enough. And I started, she was pushing me around in the playground, so I fought back and we had a fight in the playground.
Right, okay.
I think we were about 14 at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember I had red tights on and she had green tights on. And then one of the teachers came and sort of hauled us apart, and we were, you know, brought to the principal's office, headmaster, with the knees out of our tights. And after that, you know, we became best friends, and we'd play pranks on it. But she didn't bully me anymore after that because I stood up to her, you know.
My experience of Britain was that bullying is is it just happens all the time. I saw a bunch of kids on the tube once that went, I'm in my 20s, and I was like, I was almost at the point of stepping in because I thought they'd been really mean to this kid, and then I realised he was one of their mates, and it was just how they behaved.
Right.
Yeah. And I was just like, whoa, this is something. So anyway, you as a part West Indian person in an entirely white area felt a lot of pressure to
conform and be a good girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm making up for it now.
But that then led you to, like, that need to be perfectionist. This is your story, not able to laugh at yourself, which lots of us can't.
Yeah, I think that's right. A lot of people can't. And, you know, when I'm working with people, I mean, we have a lot of laughs because if you're laughing at something, it breaks it up. It can't be so much of a problem if you're laughing at it.
Right.
And when you're laughing at something, people will go, it seems ridiculous now. The problem I had, you know, 5 minutes ago, when they start laughing at it, so sometimes I might make it sound, you know, like carry it to the nth degree, whatever the problem is. And then they're just in hysterics because they go, well, that's ridiculous. And I go, is it really? And they go, yeah, I can't even think how I got there now. So it makes people change their mind or change their thinking around whatever the problem was.
It gets us into a different state of mind, and it's like
absolutely.
Things that look like problems in one state of mind are not problems in another state of mind.
Exactly.
Which so is it a problem or is it not a problem? Like, what
a problem?
Well, whatever the problem was, like, was it really a problem? Is it actually a problem, and we can't see it anymore?
Because one of the things
was never
is,
a problem, and
the,
we couldn't see that.
Is the problem is never the problem. The problem is the way we think about the problem. I've got a poster with that on because I always remind people the problem is not the problem. It's the way the person's thinking about the problem that's the problem. Because when, you know, I teach practitioners, they'll be, you know, maybe doing an exercise and the person they're with, they'll be telling them this story and they'll be going, oh, you know, oh, that's terrible. Have you thought about doing this? And I go, hang on a minute, you know, it's not your problem. You know, that isn't really the problem. The problem is the way they're thinking about it. Because if somebody else had that, it wouldn't be a problem for them.
Mm.
So they have to get out of that thinking that that's a problem and focus on how is the person thinking about the problem and how can we change the way they think about the problem so they can solve it.
Can we use some kind of example out there?
Yeah, give me an example.
I don't know. I'm intending to go to huge, big problems, but that's probably not going to help us. Or anything.
Well, it might do. If it's a huge, big problem, we can have a laugh at that.
What? My tendency, I haven't been able to wipe this circuit from my mind, but I immediately go for political things. But if we don't zero in on a specific political thing and just say generally politics is surrounded by people taking themselves very seriously,
right?
And problems are big problems. And, of course, if you're a member of the opposition, you amplify the problems.
Right, and it's but that's all, not your problem,
it's
is
all
it?
Like the problems and we How could do it? We could do with it. Like, this is where I'm going to where you are, which is we could do with making a joke about that and chilling out a bit about a lot of the stuff that's
sorry
that wasn't a comedy choke there.
No,
that was real. Am I making sense?
So you're saying that
there's so many things that people get excited about and angry about around politics, and our politicians are good at stoking that. It's almost creating problems. If we could have
it's
a laugh,
a bit general.
If we could have a laugh, yeah,
it's
I know.
It's a bit general because not everybody's like that, you see. So some people just ignore them all.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I think poking fun of our politicians and our leaders is important.
Well, let's give you another example that might be more specific. So if somebody's anxious about something, or fearful about something, there's only a certain amount of ways that they can do that. So one is that they see something. And then they think about it and that causes them to feel fearful or anxious. Okay?
Yes.
Or they hear something and then think about that and that causes them to feel anxious. Or they feel something physically and think about that and that causes them to feel anxious. Or they just think about things that cause them to feel anxious, right? So the common denominator between all of those things is the thinking.
Yeah.
Right. So if they're thinking, you know, like, let me see if I can think of an example. Somebody goes, oh, yeah. Well, I'll give you an example from ages ago. I feel anxious when I have to drive onto the motorway.
Yep.
And I have to, you know, merge like a zip.
Yes.
And I go, okay, so how do you do that? Oh, well, you know, I know where I'm going to go and I know that I've got to get on the motorway and I start getting really tense. And I go, okay, so what are you seeing when you're starting feeling really tense? Well, you know, I imagine that there's going to be an accident, that somebody's going to hit me or I'm going to hit somebody. And I go, okay, well, that'd be really useful if you're going to go on the motorway, just imagining somebody's going to hit you, you know.
The power of visualisation.
Yeah. And, you know, what would that sound like? You know, oh, God, you know. And so they start to realise what they're actually doing, because people are doing these things on autopilot. They're not aware that they're creating it themselves. They just feel anxious when they go on the motorway, and they go, oh, it's when I'm after merge like a zip kind of thing, you know. So when they realise what they're doing in their head, and I go, yeah, well, if I was doing that in my head, I'd be bloody scared as well, you know, because it must sound and feel awful. You know, what could you do instead? So it's kind of like, what are they doing? And what is this is their strategy for creating anxiety or fear. This is just an example.
Well, it's a strategy. You could write it down. Here's our three-point plan for making myself anxious.
Yeah, everybody has a strategy for doing things or a program.
Yeah, not
for
a plan,
things.
Not a planned strategy, but it's a strategy nonetheless. It works like one. Yeah,
and part of my job, and when I'm teaching NLP practitioners, is to find out what people's strategy is, because then you can change it. You know, and also once they realise what it is, they're going, okay, well, that's ridiculous. We'll give you another example. Years and years ago, I had this guy come to see me, and he, I'm sure I've mentioned him before, he sat, it was in Auckland, and it was in a centre where there was a lot of rooms, and there was a receptionist. So the receptionist rang up, and she said, "Oh, your client's here," and it was like first thing on a Monday morning at 9 o'clock. So I go out there, and there's this guy sitting there with his head down, you know, almost in his lap. And I sort of bent over and said, "Hello, good morning." And he said, "Oh, morning." And I put my hand out to shake his hand, and he sort of just landed his hand in mine like a wet fish or something. And I said, "Would you like to come through?" So, yeah, so he's looking at the floor, and I said to him, "So, you know, what seems to be the problem?" And he goes, "Well, I'm depressed," looking at the floor again. And I said, "Oh, okay." And I said, so you're depressed?" "Yeah." I said, "Okay. And how long have you been depressed?" And he looked up and he goes, "Well, I'm 29 now, so 12 years. And I went, "Oh, okay. So you've been depressed for 12 years. I said, "And, you know, when weren't you depressed?" And he goes, "Oh, well, I was all right yesterday." And I go, "Oh, great. So you've been depressed for 12 years, but you're okay yesterday." And he goes, "Yeah." So I said to him, "So what are you doing?" He goes, "I'm a computer programmer." I was thinking, oh, this is really interesting, because he's created this program for feeling depressed. So I said to him, okay, so how do you know when to get depressed? And he's going like, "What? Which planet are you on?" You know. And I go, "Well, you know, it's a program. You know all about computer programming. So what's the first thing that you see or hear that tells you that it's time to be depressed?" And he's like, "Well, it doesn't even make any sense." And I go, "Well, if you were to know." And he goes, "Oh, well," he said, "I see somebody that looks like my ex-girlfriend, or somebody with blonde hair."
Somebody with blonde hair.
Yeah. And I said, "Okay." Well, presumably a woman with blonde hair. And yeah, I said, okay. He said, or I see somebody that's, or I hear somebody that sounds like her or says something like she would say. And I said, "Okay. Then what?" And he goes, and then he looks down to his left, which is where we talk to ourselves, and he goes, "I'll tell myself I'm a silly bugger." His words, not mine. I said, "Okay." I said, "Then what?" And then he goes, "Well, then I feel depressed." And I go, "Well, there you go. There's your program. There's your strategy. You see or hear something that looks like your ex-girlfriend. You tell yourself you're a silly bugger, and then you feel depressed." And he goes, he says, "Well, you know, that's really interesting." Or, "Well, yeah, it is. So you can't change what you see or hear, but you can change what you say to yourself." So we changed the strategy from, okay, he's still going to see people with blonde hair and people that looks like his ex-girlfriend and sound like her and all that, right? But it's what happens after that we need to change the strategy. And to, you know, like I can do, I don't know what we changed it to because it's such a long time ago, but it's like, okay, well, you know, what would be more useful? So it might be something like, I can deal with this. And then that results in a different feeling.
He says that instead of I'm a silly bugger.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we're always looking for the strategy that people have that cause them to feel the way they feel. If it's, you know, and there's also a strategy for making yourself feel good.
Yeah, we don't have those strategies nearly as much as we need them, I think.
So this is where NLP is really useful.
Like we just hope that we'll feel good. I'm depressed now and I hope I'll feel better tomorrow.
Right.
We don't have a strategy.
We don't have a strategy. Nobody teaches you that. I do, but other people don't.
Yeah.
And so then once you know what your strategy is, what your strategy is for feeling good, then you can apply it to lots of different areas of your life.
Have you actually made a strategy?
Well, I have it ages ago, but I can't even remember what it is now.
Because you don't need it.
I don't need it now.
You've internalised that circuitry, or you've developed that circuitry in your brain.
Well, the first thing is you know, it's a choice. So you can choose to be happy or you can choose to be miserable.
A lot of people want to argue with you about that.
Well, that's free to argue with me about it.
Yeah. We'll give Steph's number at the end of the interview. You can find her. You can argue with her on. Actually, we'll give you your Twitter handle. That's the place to have arguments.
Yeah, it seems to be, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Some of them are quite interesting, though. You can learn a lot when you look at the arguments that people have if they're substantive and useful, you know.
But see, I think you can. I think you're at a point where you can, like, you're close enough to you're at a high. Let's call you're at a high vibration. You're close to. You're a person who laughs a lot, and you can see those arguments on Twitter.
Yeah.
And not get drawn into that.
Yes.
Angry headspace.
Yeah, yeah.
But like I'm not quite where you are, and I can get. I have to avoid things like that. Otherwise, it's very easy to draw me in.
Right.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get drawn in, but usually I go, it's just somebody's opinion. You know, and we all, and that's the thing is that, you know, this mentality that we seem to have now of, you know, you can have an opinion as long as it agrees with mine. It's ridiculous, you know. We're never going to develop as a human race if we can only take on board other people's opinions that match yours. You've got to be able to be open and listen to other people's opinions. And that is, I think that's really lacking these days, is the ability to listen and listen with an open mind rather than thinking about what you're going to say as soon as I shut the mouth.
Yeah. Sometimes I tell myself the story that the reason we've got all the social media at the moment, which is enhancing what we were already good at, is to make it really clear. Like, actually, it's taking it to the absurd extent, like you were saying before, where it's becoming the amount of the arguing and everything is becoming so absurd that eventually, after a few years, people are going to go, actually, I don't want to feel like this anymore.
Mm.
It's too much. I want to find a strategy for being happy instead of a strategy for being angry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I remain hopeful that that will happen. I'm not sure when. It might be a little bit more to endure.
Yeah.
Till that starts to happen. But it's probably happening for some people already. There's certainly people who are keeping off social media. That's their first step for, you know, there's one way of trying to make life happier.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is with social media, it depends on what social media you look to. So, you know, if you're looking for, you know, politics and things, then that's a good strategy for getting yourself all wound up. But if you're looking, I mean, there are good things on Facebook and X and that you can look at that are uplifting.
Yeah.
You know, if you're looking at those, then you're more likely to feel at least happy and content rather than, you know, ready to tear somebody's throat out.
You've got to retrain the algorithm to what you want. You might actually have to cancel your account and get a new one.
Yeah. Change your name.
Or actually, it'd be interesting to have two accounts and just deliberately do that. Like one of them you click on. It would be interesting to look at other people's accounts
and just see what they get.
Because you think you're being presented the world, but you're being presented a narrow part of the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and other people have quite different things.
You know, I mean, everything, Google and everyone watching, you can just think about something these days, and the next thing it's in your feed, and you go, I was only thinking about that. I didn't even search for it, you know?
Even Google will have clocked what your general political orientation is, and so if you do a search for something, it'll give you, and you're like a Fox News supporter, it'll give you the Fox News article about it. And if you're with CNN or Radio New Zealand is where you go, it'll give you that version first on the list. So it keeps you away from
Stops you from
those other things,
from getting other points of view.
Yeah. So yeah, so
which then makes us even worse in terms of listening to people that might have a different point of view, because we're so
shocked by it when we see it.
And it's like, well, you can't have that point of view. It's ridiculous, you know.
So yeah, all right. So we're getting stuck now on this issue. You and I are getting stuck on talking about this serious issue. And we're supposed to be talking about how to laugh at ourselves.
Yeah, well, I was saying to you off air that you know, when I learned to laugh at myself was I got this dog. And I always think our pets teach us something. So the first dog I had was a case hound. And then when I had him, he was so naughty and wouldn't listen that I took him to obedience the day he was 6 months old, because that's when I could take. And then I really got interested in doing competitive obedience with the dog and agility. So I wanted another dog that was more suitable to doing that. So I wanted a bearded collie. So I got this bearded collie. His name was Rowf, R-O-W-F. Huh. It was the noisiest thing on four legs. Everybody called him either Rowf the Mouth or Thing on a Spring, because he used to do these sheep jumps, like straight up in the air to shoulder height.
Oh, yeah.
Usually when I was in the ring with him. And then the judge would go, 2 points off for bouncing up. Some judges wouldn't. If they had a farming background, they used to go, well, he's working, because he loved it. You know, it wasn't like he was trying to run away or anything. He just loved it working.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't dock for points like that. But every time he thought he'd done anything right, he'd bark. So, you know, in the send away, you have to send them to a point about 20 metres away to whatever the judge says to send them to. If he thought he'd done a good send away, you know, I'd go down, he'd lie down, and then he'd bark, 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 sometimes till his chest came off the ground, and that was another 2 points off, right? And in distance control, you know, you have them about, oh, I don't know, 10 metres away, and you have to give them commands that the judge tells you to on a board with stand, sit or down. So that's maybe leave your dog in a stand and you walk away, turn around, and then the next one might be sit or down. So I'd say, Rev, sit. So he'd sit, woof, woof, and then bark, bark, bark. Otherwise, people used to say, come on, let's go and have a laugh. Steph's in the ring, right? And it wasn't that they were laughing at me, although I was the handler. It was that they were laughing at Rev, you know, and I was convinced that he, for the first 3 years, I was thinking, I'm going to kill this dog, because he could do every exercise and get full points. But trying to get him to do every exercise and get full points on the same day was a bit of a problem. Even, you know, I remember being in Wellington at the National Dog Agility and Obedience Competitions. And if you think about the A-frame, it's like an A, and the dog runs up one side and down the other side,
yes,
to the
touch
point.
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
And at this one, they had the A-frame, and then underneath the A-frame was a tunnel. So the dog was supposed to go up the A-frame, down the other side, and then come around and go through the tunnel. So he went up the A-frame and down, and then instead of going through the tunnel, he went on the A-frame again. So that meant he was disqualified, you see, so he made a mistake. So, but he was going so fast that by the time I said stop, he was on right at the top of the A-frame. And I said, get down. So he tried to lie down on the top on the top of the A-frame.
Oh, no.
And all these people were cracking up laughing, and the judge was blowing the whistle, and he was like, oh, look at all these people, and they're all looking at me. And then he just barked and barked and barked. And the judge at the end of the whole week, he said, I should have a prize for the most entertaining dog. Rev would have got that, because he just did everything, you know, like just to entertain people.
Yeah.
So that forced me to laugh at myself. It was like, well, you're going to go in there. He's going to do something. It was like, I wonder what he'll create today to...
So you could have got like, did you start off just being like really upset, like, oh, the dog's ruining it for me.
I'm going, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, he can do all this good. And he was a great dog. And people, the other thing people always used to say to me, God, I love Rev. I'm so glad he's yours. Because I didn't know how to cope with him. He was barking constantly. Like, people would say, does he bark all the time? And I go, well, he only barks if he's in the back of the car, if we drive past an open paddock, or he sees other people, or another dog, or water, or if I put the indicator on, or if I slow down. basically all the time he's barking in the car, you know. But when you're out, it was kind of like a conversation.
Yeah.
And like naughty children, if they're quiet, you go, what are they? What is he doing? You know, why is he quiet? Kind of thing. You usually found a dead animal to roll in or something, you know.
Threatening silence.
So that was, it was like then after that, it was like, well, it's a different, you know, it's a different age as well. You know, I was in New Zealand. It was a fun thing to do. And I'd go, well, you know, whatever he's going to do, he's going to do. Even though he, as I say, could get, like, we were in the national dog obedience competitions one year, and the test was out of 225 points, and you go in the ring with 225 points, and then
you lose them.
So he won.
Oh, right.
With 224 out of 225.
So he could be like
And the woman that was behind was 9 points behind me. It's unheard of. It's usually half a point. 9 points behind me. He won on 224 out of 225. One crooked sit. It was crooked and I got docked a whole point. And the judge says, how did you get him to do the send away? Because the send away was an awkward one. And I went, I just told him to go to the sign. There was a sign of some dog biscuits or something. And it was an awkward, usually it's like corner to corner or straight ahead, and this was like on an angle. And he did it perfectly, and he didn't bark or get up or anything. And I was like, oh, my God, and he won, you know.
So he could do it, but it was just more fun to do other things.
It was more fun to look at the audience and go, oh, look. And he'd be like, oh, look, they're looking at me, bark, bark, bark. And then if we went from slow pace to fast pace, that's when he'd do these sheep jumps. So the judges say slow pace, so you're walking at slow pace and the dog's glued to your leg, you know, and then they go, fast pace. And so you have to pick up speed all of a sudden. That's when he'd jump up and bark in my ear, you know. He wouldn't lose place. He'd just be off the ground.
So he's still moving. In a horizontal line, he'd be on the map. He's still the same speed. But,
exactly.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that we can laugh at ourselves because, you know, well, if you can't, then everybody else will laugh at you instead. So.
Well, that's the situation you would have been in at the start, wasn't it? Everyone was laughing at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you either got to get on board with that or go home. Maybe.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there we go. That's good. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that chat about your crazy dog, who you don't have. That's a. Two dogs previous now, isn't it? For you.
Three
previous. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, actually, you showed me a photo of you with him. You look very different. This great mop of black curly hair looking more West Indian.
Yeah, that's right.
Probably, yeah, yeah.
And it was probably summer. I'm always a bit darker in the summer.
Your hair goes darker in the summer?
No, my skin does.
Oh, your skin. All right, I was going to say. My hair goes blonder in the summer if I take my hat off. We were going to talk about some other things. We're kind of out of time.
Well, we're going to talk about the courses.
Do you want to just mention them?
Yeah.
This is what Steph actually does aside from chatting to me.
So I've got an NLP practitioner training coming up on the 16th of September, so 3 months today basically. And it's 18 days training over 3 months. Or there's the power of personal change, which is about changing yourself so that you can influence other people in the world. And that's the first block of practitioner training, but it's also a standalone course. And I've also got the Inside Your Mind course running in Thames on the 21st of July.
So who's that, like that big 18-day one?
That's for people that want to become NLP practitioners.
Right, okay.
Which is basically, you know, I mean, I don't understand why anybody wouldn't want to be an NLP practitioner because it's so useful in all areas of your life.
Yeah.
But if people aren't sure, they can do the Inside Your Mind one or they can do just the first block and see how they feel about that.
So you don't do it all in 3 weeks or four weeks? You spread it out over big gaps?
Spread it out over 3 months, yeah. Yeah, okay. So you've got a chance to learn and then integrate it. And they can go to insideyourmind.com and all the information's there. And they might go and find those Tommy Cooper jokes.
I want to see a video of your old dog, but I guess there probably isn't a video.
No, I think I have got some, but on actual DVDs, which I haven't got anything to play them on at the moment.
Oh, give them to me. We'll sort them out.
Oh, okay.
Soon before all the equipment they can play DVDs dies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they were transferred from videos.
I bet, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's hard living through this era. I don't know if it's going to keep changing. I can't see how it can. Like, now it's all data files and just sits on a hard drive somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But who knows what we'll come up with next.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, so people can check out, we call the segment Inside Your Mind, but that's also the name of your business. I stole it from there. So if people go to insideyourmind.com,
they
can find out about all the stuff.
And you can find out there's quite a few articles about language and laughter and how to be happy and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
All on there.
Good stuff. All right. Thanks, Steve.